Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk World Radio, we are joined by Howard Yaris, who is an economist, professor, attorney, businessman, and activist who teaches at New York University and has published a new edition of a book called Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think, and more important than you know. Howard Yaris, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Thanks for doing it. Thanks for writing this book. Can you talk a little bit about how it is important? Because the closing chapters of the book address the problem of inequality and what to do about it. How does understanding economics help people do that?
Well, I think there's a fundamental problem in that most Americans do not take a course in economics. I went to high school in New York City, and we were required to take a course in trigonometry, but not economics. Now, I have a high regard for math. I was a math major in college, but come on. Economics is much more important for people's lives. And then for those who do take it in college, they're usually given a barrage of formulas and assumptions and technical jargon that really doesn't connect to the real world. So my thought was to write a book that enabled people to see what economics is about. It's about values. It's about how all the stuff that our economy produces. It's about who does what and who gets what. And underlying economics are important value judgments. And the bottom line point is that if you cede those judgments to politicians or to quote-unquote experts, you may very well not get the decisions that you think are fair or right or good. And so the goal of the book, again, is to give people the fundamental knowledge and the confidence to look at these issues, try to understand them, and then make judgments about them on their own, and hopefully we'll get a better society as a result, as more people get involved in making these decisions.
I like to focus on the what should we do part, which comes at the end of the book, but maybe you can fill us in on how a basic understanding of economics informs the ideas. One is to boost minimum wages and allow unionization, which I, of course, agree with and think a lot of people agree with, and some states are doing to some degree, but the federal government seems pretty broken. How can we do this better with understanding of economics?
Well, I think a lot of people, I'll give you a concrete example. It's much easier to talk with a concrete example. A lot of people listened to the presidential debates just over a year ago and heard the current president say he's going to bring down prices on day one. Now, if you read the book, you would know that's impossible. You can't bring down prices in an economy unless you throw it into a terrible recession. And so people would have said, well, if he's telling the truth, do I really want a terrible recession? An economy where businesses are failing, people are getting thrown out of jobs, and hence prices start dropping. So that's the way to bring prices down. There's no other way to bring prices down. So that's an example of where you might have had a different outcome if there was a better standing of basic economics.
Something that perhaps you could do on day one, though no U.S. presidential candidate would ever mention it in my wildest fantasies, would be the next recommendation, which you have in the book, which is create government jobs. You could do that, right?
You could do that, but that would not bring prices down. That's a way to address inequality. It's a way to address a lot of problems. Inflation is not among them. That's not a recipe for addressing inflation. So yes, that would be a way to, it would be a simpler way to deal with a lot of inequality than a lot of the proposals we have, like a wealth tax. Again, that's another example that comes from the other side of the political spectrum. How exactly would you implement a wealth tax? And this is just an observation. When other countries have implemented a wealth tax, wealth tends to leave the country. So how do you prevent that? So again, these are there are a lot of simplistic solutions to the problems, the very real problems we're facing. And I think we'd get better solutions if people were more informed and more able to evaluate what politicians were saying and thereby make better choices.
I like the creating jobs idea. I think it's wonderful. You never hear it. It seems to uphold an existing law called the Humphrey-Hawkins Full Employment Act. But I have the huge question of what kind of jobs, because we have government spending, at least the discretionary part, looking like it could hit 75% going to wars and militaries and police and weapons, which seems like an issue for those of us who want life on Earth to survive, no matter what sort of economic system we have. But also because, to my knowledge, studies have shown that that kind of spending produces a lot fewer jobs than pretty much any other kind of spending, or even than not taxing working people and spending the money at all.
Yes, and with the AI revolution, the pressure on jobs is going to be even greater. So there are innumerable jobs helping disabled people or old people, teaching students, keeping our streets clean and safe. There are just a lot of labor-intensive jobs that are going unfilled in a way that we just put up with a lot of shortcomings in a lot of areas that we don't need to. And I think if the government focused more on that and not on the capital-intensive activities like producing bombs, we would see a more satisfied and more involved population. I think people would find that to be very beneficial. Also, the point I make in the book is that you don't even need a minimum wage at that point. You just have a wage that the government pays, and that de facto becomes a minimum wage. And for the few people who want to work for less, God bless them. So it also reduces the heavy hand of the government to some extent.
God bless them, but they can't pay their bills. I don't know
Well,
how God
that's their
bless them.
decision. That's their decision. Maybe they're rich and they don't care. They want to take this job and whatever. Again, it's just making there's another thing that doesn't come across in the book as much as it should, and that is making it government simpler. One of the reasons why we have such great inequality, I make two points in the book. Why is inequality exploding? One is the internet, the cost-free platform of doing business internationally. When my father was in business, to set up a shop across the country would have been incredibly expensive. Jeff Bezos can now do his Amazon business throughout the world using the cost-free platform of the internet. So that's allowed a winner-take-all economy. But there's something else going on, and that's the tax code. It's 50,000 pages. And if you have enough money to hire enough clever tax lawyers, you could essentially evade the need to pay taxes. And that's what's happening, especially at the very highest end of the spectrum. And that just needs to stop.
One of the ideas for simplicity that I recall from the book was getting rid of taxing corporations and just taxing individual investments. Politically, that seems like, lunacy because people don't like corporations and people kind of like people. But it may nonetheless be a great idea. What can you explain?
Well, this is so interesting. I received some criticism of the book, some coming from the left that said I was too far right, and some coming from the right that said I was too far left. And my answer is, does the policy make sense? Whether it comes from the left or the right or the middle, wherever it comes from, does it make sense? And that's what I think a lot of people just revert to, oh, that's a left-wing policy or that's a right-wing policy. That's not helpful. What is helpful is to think of the policy, and is this going to be good for me? Is it going to be good for the country? That's the analysis that people should do, not whether this is left-wing or right-wing. The corporate income tax raises about 8% of all revenue the federal government raises. I was an executive in a big corporation. I can't even convey to you the amount of resources that are used to preparing these taxes that are involved in putting these things together. Plus, there's also the distortions that are caused by tax policy that causes corporations to do this and not that, or that and not this. If you just eliminated it and increased taxes on human beings by 8%, you have basically created a boom in the economy that would really benefit everyone. So that's, I'm not necessarily saying that's the best policy, but it's a policy worth thinking about. It's a policy that should not be immediately dismissed because it doesn't come from your side of the political spectrum.
But when you say human beings, you mean human beings who make investments as opposed to human beings who get all their sustenance from pay for their work.
Well, this is something that goes exactly to values. There are two types of income. Every dollar earned in America is in one bucket. It's either work income or investment income. That's it. And right now, we tax work income higher than we tax investment income, which causes, aside from the inequity of that, and I would argue that is objectively inequitable, because clearly investment income is concentrated among more wealthy individuals rather than income from labor, which is disproportionately people who are not wealthy. It causes distortions because then wealthy people take their labor income and try to convert it into investment income. And that's what happened with the carried interest provision or loophole, whatever you call it, for hedge fund managers. Hedge fund managers, on average, pay lower tax rates than teachers simply because they convert their earned income, their work income, into investment income, thereby lowering the tax rate on their income. So again, there are all these distortions in the tax code. So I think it's a very good argument from an equity perspective and a simplicity perspective to have one tax rate for all sorts of income. And so, yes, investment income should be taxed at the same rate as work income, eliminating that distortion and thereby increasing the tax on investment income.
One rate modified progressively so that the wealthy pay more, or flat tax?
Flat tax would be very inequitable because right now we have graduated tax and the wealthy are still figuring out a way to weasel out of those high tax brackets. So to eliminate the high tax brackets would be a great disservice. I have a question for you. Do you remember the tax rate under Republican Dwight Eisenhower, the top tax rate?
I obviously don't remember it unless I appear older than I actually am, but to my knowledge—
It's also before my time, but I—
It was around 90, right?
Yeah, 91%. And under Barack Obama, it was 39.6%, and he was called a socialist. So I think the goalpost has been moved enormously. And I think, again, during Dwight Eisenhower's presidency, the U.S. was doing extremely well, by most measures, better than it's doing today. So the thought that higher tax rates would tank the economy is just not backed up by facts. So again, there's a precedent for this. We had 91% tax rates under Republican Dwight Eisenhower. We had 71% tax rates under Republican Richard Nixon. This problem can be addressed. It's not an economic problem, it's a political problem. And the reason for the book is people just, their eyes glaze over when they hear about taxes, when they hear about economics, and they can't, because important value judgments are being made when these policies are enacted. And if they don't assert their values, someone else's values are getting asserted. And given the amount of money in the political system, you and I and your listeners presumably know whose values those are.
We're speaking with Howard Yaris, and the book is called Understandable Economics, and I'm trying to understand it. Washington State, the governor has just signed into law something that the state of Massachusetts did a few years back, and that is put in an income tax just on high income above $1 million, brings in trillions of dollars, impacts a very small number of people who threaten to leave the state but don't. Is this a useful step, considering that waiting for Washington, D.C. doesn't work very well?
It can be, but you have to be very careful. New Jersey learned that if you bump up taxes too high on wealthy people, they leave, and there was a big gap in New Jersey's revenue. The problem is when you say leave, it's really not leave. That's a misnomer. What it is re-domicile. Donald Trump did that from New York to Florida a few years ago. You don't actually necessarily have to just pick up your home and leave the way a middle-income person would do. Typically, these people at the very, very top of the income spectrum or wealth spectrum have multiple homes. And so what you're seeing now in California with the wealth tax that may be enacted is some of the wealthiest people in California, Mark Zuckerberg, Sergey Brin, buying these great properties in Florida. And I think it's not that they suddenly want the great weather. I think it's that they're preparing to redomicile. Again, these are people who travel all over the world, who own multiple homes. And I think what they're preparing to do is to say, well, their main residence is now Florida and not California. So that's a real risk. And when they do that, you don't only lose the increase in taxes, but you lose every penny of taxes that they would pay to the state. So the downside, if it does, is enormous if a small percentage of these people leave. So on a state level, you have to be really careful. There is clear evidence showing that small increases in state taxes don't cause an exodus. But there isn't much evidence with regard to significant increases in taxes, with in particular taxes on wealth. There really isn't much evidence on that. So states have to be very careful. That said, these kind of taxes are extremely effective at the national level, because I don't think any of these people are willing to give up their citizenship and not return to the United States. So that's very effective. But yes, it's something that the states need to look at, but they have to be really careful in a way that the federal government would.
So if you were the federal government, or the federal government answered to the U.S. public, we might see progressive income taxes, negative income taxes, taxes on inheritance, estates, et cetera.
I make the point in the book that people who inherit money are even better off than the people who have the money. Because to make this as simple as possible, if I buy a stock for $1 and it goes to $10 and then I sell it, I have to pay tax on $9. A lower tax, I'll add, than you pay on $9 of income from your hard work. But I do pay tax, the capital gains tax, on the $9 of income. If my heirs inherited that $10 stock, they could sell it no tax. It's called a stepped up basis. And it's just a giveaway. It's kind of shocking. And I think most people, again, people's eyes glaze over when they hear about tax policy. But as Willie Sutton said about banks, that's where why he robbed banks. That's where the money is. And the tax code allocates trillions of dollars. And that's really where the money is.
I don't think this came up at all in the book, but it seems that a lot of people think inequality could also be addressed in part by busting up the damn monopolies. I mean, you go into what is capitalism, what is socialism, et cetera, but capitalism dominated by monopolies or cartels of a handful of companies monopolizing together is not what most people imagine as capitalism, but it is what we've got, right?
Yeah, it's capitalism has some flaws. A lot of people think, oh, it just takes on naturally. Well, it's like a highway. If there aren't clear rules, you're supposed to drive on the right side. You're not supposed to be drunk. You're not supposed to go through red lights. No one gets anywhere. The whole thing breaks down. And it's the same with capitalism. There are all sorts of problems that a market economy produces. And you pointed out one of the most prominent of them, and that is monopolization or control of an industry by a small group of people. Because once that happens, you can't really compete. The whole reason capitalism works is there's always the threat that someone will come in and offer a better product at a better price. And so it keeps people honest. But once that threat goes away, it doesn't work anymore. And that's happened in so many sectors. I mentioned before the winner-take-all technology. The internet has allowed the few really great producers to sort of monopolize whole industries. You know, Uber with Uber and Lyft monopolize or small oligopoly. Uber and Lyft with regard to transportation services, Amazon with regard to retail. Facebook with regard to social networking. They're able to monopolize whole industries the way that was not possible in the past. And the only way to address that is through government intervention.
Again, we're speaking with Howard Yaris and the book Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think and more important than you know. The book is very much well written for any audience, right, left, center, etc., which, of course, leads to me quibbling with parts of it from the left. I had a hard time getting into it. I liked the end of the book better, but the beginning, I mean, you say things like, whether we will one day reach a limit to growth in our economy's output is uncertain. But why shouldn't the devastating collapse of ecosystems count as a limit?
Well, that's not a necessary outcome if we have appropriate eco-legislation. I heard recently, yesterday, someone was talking about some protests against Palantir, the defense contractor. And my thought is, why are you protesting them? Your government, the government we elected, the government that reports to us, is seeking out their services. That's where you should be doing your work. Our government, the people who work for us in the White House, are seeking out these services. We need to tell them no. It's not the service provider that's really at fault, if you think about it. It's not Elon Musk, who pays no taxes because of the tax code that we, our representatives, enacted. It's on us. Shakespeare said it best, the fault is not in our stars, but in ourselves. And so, yes, there are major ecological issues we're facing. But we need to tell our representatives, put the restraints on business so that it, one, doesn't make it worse, and two, hopefully tries to reverse it in some extent. If we just say, well, ExxonMobil, we hope they do something about the environment, maybe we'll have 10 people protest, that's not going to do anything. We have to realize this is something that people forget. Trump is our employee, to be really blunt about it. And if we don't like the job he's doing, we need to fire him. I think people don't take their role as a voter in a democracy seriously enough. All of these people are their employees. You have to think of it as if you're running a business. Do you want these people working for you? And that kind of thinking is not as common as it should be.
I mean, you make perfect sense. That ought to work in practice as in theory. If we're going to have a representative government, we ought to be able to go to the government, have it represent us and deal with corporations and other entities. The fact is that in recent years, people have found that they can influence banks and universities and corporations and get them to divest from wars and get them to change their policies. And if you can name a single popular demonstration that has influenced Donald Trump in any way, I would love to hear it. You know, if you think there's a way to vote against Palantir in a congressional or presidential election, I would love to know who that candidate is. You know, this is people's problem.
Well, there are a lot of candidates who don't think Americans should be surveilled in their private life. And there are a lot of candidates who do. And so the goal is to vote for the candidates who are against that kind of surveillance and convince your friends and neighbors to join you. And that's the way change is made. But again, if you're hoping that ExxonMobil and the like are going to suddenly be kind to the environment on their own, no, it takes rules from the EPA to do that effectively. And yes, there's anecdotal evidence of rare, I don't think there's even that much anecdotal evidence of businesses just voluntarily restraining themselves. There's also another issue with competition, that if a business decides to be virtuous and restrain itself, well, a competitor could just come along and decide to be less virtuous and put the virtuous business out of business. So that's a problem in a fair market economy where there aren't sufficient rules to protect the environment.
Very true. Let me ask about other things that tripped me up in reading the book. Quote, for almost all of human history, prior to the last couple of hundred years, most people had few possessions, lived much shorter and less healthy lives, and often faced hunger or worse, end quote. Seems like a statement about Western history, not about indigenous societies, not about the incredibly lengthy prehistory of humanity, for a lot of which many people had few possessions, but at least once they got past infancy, did not necessarily have shorter and less healthy lives, or did they?
Well, you mentioned prehistory. People were living in caves, looking, hoping to have a successful hunt or die. Doesn't sound like a kind of life I would want.
People were living in all kinds of habitations, not just caves.
Prehistory was pretty much, before the agricultural revolution, people were pretty much hunter-gatherers. They were nomadic. And they were just on,
right.
Maybe,
and it's become at the very least controversial to claim that hunter-gatherers died young.
Whether they died young or not, it just doesn't seem like the kind of life I would want to lead every day, not knowing whether I was going to starve to death, living outside and just going from place to place. I don't know, it may sound like alluring to you, but it really doesn't sound like the kind of life I would want to lead.
Well, I think polling would put you in a minority, but I think switching from die young to could starve to death any day is the same sort of assertion, and I'm not sure that there's a consensus any longer that that's what hunter-gatherer.
Oh, I'm making a value judgment. I would not want to be living outside knowing any day I couldn't kill an animal, I would starve to death, and dealing with the elements and just going from place to place and not having a permanent place that has any amenities. It's a value judgment. That's not how I would want to live.
Another thing
is, by the way, that lifestyle is available to you. You can just leave your house and go and get a spear and just see how you do. That lifestyle is available. I don't see many people choosing.
In certain parts of the world, it's somewhat available still. I'm not sure it would work in New York City. I'm not sure it would work here.
No, but you can certainly go to those parts of the world and live outdoors with a spear and see how you fare. That option is available to people. I don't see people racing to elect it, though.
I'm not sure how easily available it is to everyone, and people do care about their families and other things as well. So it's tricky, but
but in the prehistory, you were with your family living outdoors, and presumably the adults were the people trying to spear the animals to get the food for the family.
Indeed, but you might want to bring your family if you were traveling halfway around the world in this moment. In any case, I have a million more questions, but we don't have any more minutes. And I want to say thank you very, very much to Howard Yaris. The book, you should get it. It's called Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think and more important than you know. Howard, thank you very much for coming on Talk World Radio.
Hi, thanks. This was a lot of fun.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.